Good evening, and welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And mine's Philip Cobbins.
This week, we're going to talk about the exciting new History Channel series that Philip has been a part of called Ancient Aliens. Philip, tell us a little bit about Ancient Aliens, and then we'll start elaborating on some of the subject matter.
Well, Ancient Aliens is one of those documentaries which has been, or it seems to like they have been, 1,000 years in the making. To actually go back to the very beginning, not just of the documentary, but of the entire question of have we been visited by alien beings in the past, it was really made popular in 1968 when Eric von Däniken wrote a book called Chariots of the Gods. And the question which he posed numerous times, in fact, he prides himself, Eric, that there were over 360 question marks in that book, was whether or not we were visited by alien beings in the past. Because he was looking around these ancient monuments, and he was then reading the guidebooks, and he was then reading the historical academic reports. Sounds familiar, Kathleen?
Mm-hmm.
And he somehow wasn't satisfied with what they were saying. So he said, either our ancestors are absolutely stupid, and in that case, it has to mean that an extraterrestrial civilization came here and built or helped us build these monuments, or our ancestors weren't as stupid, and they actually built these things, but there was a highly advanced civilization in the past who helped us do these things. Obviously, he was ridiculed, he was attacked, he was laughed at in certain corners. There was an entire campaign which was out there to discredit him, but Eric persisted and just kept doing things. In recent years, Eric got his second breath because it was becoming obvious that some of the questions he had asked were legitimate, that science actually had been pushed into a corner and had to reply. For example, in the early 1970s, they had done nothing whatsoever about the Nazca Lines. And when he asked the question, did alien spaceships land here, they were embarrassed because they, even though they said, of course, no spaceship has ever landed here, they couldn't actually prove or say what the Nazca Lines were. So they had to dig, and they actually came up with an answer which didn't mean that the spaceships had landed there. But they realized that von Däniken had an effect, and so he began to ask similar questions and kept asking some newer questions. And then the likes of Giorgio Tsoulakos, who was an American student at the time, became very interested in the entire movement. And Eric has always been one of those people who wants to inspire youngsters to ask questions, that rather than just go out there and check it out for themselves. Sounds familiar, Kathy?
Yes, it does.
And so he kept asking these questions. And obviously, by that time, Eric had survived 2 decades of sometimes horrendous and intense attack. And the question then was, can we do something on television? Because they felt that the time was ripe. So they also knew that whenever television had done this thing in the past, had touched the subject in the past, it had been an utter disgrace. It was to basically make a mockery of everybody who appeared on that. And even in like 1995, when, for example, Graham Hancock did a documentary, the BBC just went so after him that it really was sad to watch. And actually the BBC got a conviction for unfair treatment afterwards. So this is kind of like the thing which Eric, Graham Hancock, and people in the ancient aliens field had to be up against. And so a few years ago, people felt that perhaps time had changed, that something should be done. And then Giorgio really went out and tried to get documentary companies interested in doing something. And he finally persuaded a company, Prometheus Pictures, to do a 2-hour special for the History Channel. And that was aired last May. And the History Channel learned that this was a phenomenal success. It was the most watched, the highest rated show which they were doing. And so the History Channel said, can we have some more? And can we have this as soon as we can? And they were aiming for August of 2009. Now, we all know that that is simply impossible to pull off, specifically if you want to have any kind of quality in filming and screenwriting and interviewing in there. So they were working very hard. They interviewed an awful lot of people in December through to March. And the end result is 5 episodes. The first one aired on the 20th of April. The last one will air at the end of May. Each one with a specific theme. and each one lasting 2 hours, and in each one as well, it'll have some people who are just specific to a show, and then some people who, like me and Giorgio, who appear in a few more shows and are one of those faces who briefly jump in and out of the frame just to kind of like make a continuance and guide the viewer through the entire question which is being posed.
I think for those who have not seen it, you know, the History Channel is pretty famous for repeating things about a gazillion times. So if you go into your DVR and your guides, you should be able to find Ancient Aliens pretty easily. So it should be easy to find. You can go out there, you can start TiVoing it or watch it live. But I definitely recommend that you do that. And the episodes are going to be coming up, and I'm sure they'll be repeating some of the older episodes as well. But I want to say that I think you were phenomenal in it. I think you look and sound fantastic. And, you know, one of the many things that I love about you is that you really come across on this special as the voice of reason. I really feel that your answers in a lot of these situations were really, really measured and really sound and really, really solid. And I think actually a lot of people on it are. I mean, clearly some of the guest speakers on the show have a very solid opinion. And periodically that opinion comes across as aliens did everything. Everything that has ever happened, monumental and fantastic in history, is the result of alien intervention, alien help, alien assistance. And I have a little bit of a problem with that, and that's one of the things I want to talk to you about, because I'm not a big fan of that point of view for a number of reasons. I'm not a big fan of a machine did this, a device did this, aliens created this, for the reason that I think that what happens is we tend to get a little bit invested in this alien intelligence came and gave us everything that we have. And I think that that makes me, maybe it's an ego problem. Maybe it's just me as a human feeling that I am being disempowered and that the human race is being diminished by saying we weren't capable of doing any of these things ourselves. We had to have all of this alien intervention to give us everything that we needed in order to create all these monuments and miracles. And I chafe at that. That's a problem for me. So, I mean, we'll talk about it in terms of specific issues. There's an issue that happens in the first episode that I took tremendous issue with. And we'll talk about that because I know you actually did not comment on it in the show. And I think you didn't comment on it in the show for the same reasons that I don't like it. But I want to first ask you generally, you know, how you feel about that point of view, this idea that, you know, the human race is not capable of doing magnificent things without the help of alien intervention. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think it's part and parcel of a bigger problem. So I think I need to begin with the big problem, which is, and it's one of those taglines, but it is also true, that for a number of years, Western civilization lived with this idea that we were created by God in 4004 BC. And then when that got thrown out, when the good Bishop Usher got ushered out, you know, we replaced and said, well, civilization has begun roughly about that period in time. Agriculture has become a part like that. And we have not adapted this. It is not true. We have got Jericho. We have got Kataluwak. More recently, we've got Göbekli Tepe. We have pushed the boundaries of civilization, of tremendous artwork, of sophistication, of understanding of the cosmos back to roughly 10,000 BC. And that isn't preached to children. That's not preached in schools. And when I went to school, which is about 20 years ago, we were studying ancient Egypt. At one point, our history teacher was ill, and we got a substitute. And the substitute was actually the director of the school itself. And he began, before opening a book, the very book which we were reading about ancient Egypt, he opened and said the statement, well, you know, the Greeks invented everything. Even though we were reading about ancient Egypt. And this is still so very much out there. For example, every Greek scholar, whether it's Plato or Pythagoras, will say, we went to Egypt and we learned this. We learned philosophy, we learned mathematics, we learned this, we learned that. However, popularly and within academic circles, we still have got this belief that the Greeks did everything. Eric Hornung, who is the most vile creature when it comes to Egyptology, oh yes, and I'm even actually kind to him, has come up with this glib statement which says that the contribution of Egypt to religion, philosophy and culture in general is nil. And he gets quoted and he gets away with that.
It's outrageous.
This is where we stand on an academic level. This is kind of like, you know, the mindset of the ordinary person who is confronted with a basic education or even an academic education and doesn't challenge the opinions. So widely against that is saying the ancient alien hypothesis. Now, I don't, you know, I am one of those people who actually feels, and I think that the first TV documentary actually repeated it twice. My statement is this. It is possible that in the past we have been visited by an alien civilization. And there is certain potential evidence, which actually was highlighted in that documentary, which suggests that this is the case. Things like the little flying machine, and specifically Pumapunku in South America, are anomalous finds. They are very localized finds. Pumapunku doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And unfortunately, they didn't have the money or the budget to go to Pumapunku, and they didn't have a photograph of it. But this is what I always say is, like, to me, the single most interesting piece of evidence that an alien intelligence might have been behind Pumapunku. And it's very simple. It is one stone. And on one side of the stone, you have got an incision of a pentagram. And it goes into the stone. And it comes out on another side, and it has become a hexagram. So it's gone from 5 points to 6 points. There is not a single machine in the world right now who is able to create such a thing. Nor has anybody ever come up with any reasonable reason why anybody today would need to have such an opening, and why definitely somebody would need to have such an opening about 1,000 years ago. Now, there's a possible one, but we haven't come up with one. And this is kind of, you know, from a carving point of view, together with all the rest of Pumapunku, so special that we, I think, in those cases, need to ask the question. And you know, it's a question, it's not an answer. At the same time, there is so much else in history, the Nazca lines, and so many other things, whereby I do not think we need to ask that question. And as you said, sometimes I think subjects where the question doesn't need to be asked nevertheless still gets included. And that is something of a shame. And also think that sometimes the problem with the ancient alien question is that they go too far overboard. For example, the Great Pyramid. The Great Pyramid is a tremendous building work, just from a purely project management point of view. And we can actually put perhaps the link up on the website. I once, actually not once, about a year and a half ago, was invited to speak in front of a group of select project managers in Dubai. And they were building the largest structures in the world, the highest building on planet Earth. The guy who built that was in the audience, and he was a fellow speaker at that conference. And they were interested in kind of, you know, each time they did something special and a special thing. And just from a purely project management point of view perspective, you can show how Egyptologists get completely wrong as to how it was all built. And then when you add another layer to it, like, for example, the work which Joseph Davidovich has done, who says basically that there are very simple ways in which the Great Pyramid could have been built, and it's too technical to go into. But, you know, he's an accepted professor. He is considered to be the father of his category of science. He has created an entire science of his own. But once again, he's ridiculed by Egyptologists. These people, the project managers and the Davidoviches, sit in between Egyptology and the extreme question of, like, oh, ancient aliens did this. And what I didn't like and don't like in general is that they get bypassed just to make it a sensational claim. Oh, well, we know the Egyptologists are wrong, therefore the alien has to have made it.
Right.
And it is bypassing very clear research and very good research in the middle. And I guess that's probably why I am the voice of reason, who kind of like always sits there in the middle and gets called by the skeptics a believer and by the believer a skeptic.
You can't win. But this is actually something that I, you know, take issue with and also believe in strongly, which is that there is so often a middle ground, and it doesn't have to be you know, black or white. This pendulum doesn't have to swing in you know, so far in both directions. Because I do definitely agree with you that what tends to happen, and we see this all over the place in archaeology, we see it in history, you know, if we can't explain something, then we'll go overboard with it. Okay, well, we don't know what the Great Pyramid is, or we don't know what the Shroud of Turin is, but we know what it isn't. You know, we know that we can't create it today in the 21st century with any of our modern equipment. That's what we know. That's what we know about the Great Pyramid. That's what we know about a lot of these things. But I think to automatically default to the fact that alien intelligence came from another planet and created it, or gave us the means of creating it, is a rash thing to do periodically. Now, let me say, I'm not normally a skeptic, but I'm a pretty rational person, and I think more importantly, I'm a humanist. So I want to believe that in these magnificent brains of ours, in this extraordinary spirit of ours, in these incredible memories and matter and things that we bring with us into this life, which we don't even understand a fraction of, that we have this intelligence, this desire, this understanding, and maybe even these memories to do this kind of stuff ourselves. And I like to think that the ancient wonders of the world, the Great Pyramid, the Nazca Lines, I like to think that all of those things were accomplished by the extraordinary spirits and minds of human beings.
Yes, and definitely. And this is kind of like, you know, the good angle, if you want, to Von Däniken asking that question, like, are the Nazca Lines a spaceport? The answer is no. You wouldn't be able to land even a normal plane on it. But as ridiculous as the question is, it actually pushed these extreme academic people who were not even kind of like, you know, considering going there, because it's a desert and it's really not a nice environment. You know, and unfortunately, nobody had ever studied it, so they couldn't even sit in their armchairs. They really had to go out there.
Oh, no, that's academic hell. They have to actually go outside of a library.
I know. So, you know, he pushed them in there. But guess what? You know, like, they found the answers. And to some extent, actually what they found is really interesting. And it's interesting on two levels. One of them is this. They came away with two options. With one conclusion and then two interpretations of that conclusion. And the conclusion was this, that all these lines represented paths which the souls of the deceased were believed to take or took in the afterlife. So it's a gigantic mind map, really, which was projected onto the landscape. And the locals definitely believed that these beings, obviously the souls, were meant to fly over there, and it would be the souls of the deceased or the shaman in out-of-body travel who would be looking down upon it and see it from above high, because everybody was in agreement that it had to be seen from height. And a spin-off of is actually that there is quite some thinking and quite some thought going into the process that the people in Nazca, very ordinary human beings like you and I, might actually have invented or used a very basic hot air balloon to actually check or see these things from above. So it's this multi-leveled perspective. And again, you know, Von Däniken put a very radical theory out there, and the answer, I think, is actually precisely what you say. It kind of like, you know, the answer is yes. It has shown unknown dimensions to us, and it has shown that we were very ingenious in the past. Now, I don't know whether Nazca is going to make it into this series or not, but if it does, I would hope that actually the new information about Nazca is actually put in there, because again, I would feel it's quite disingenuous if this you know, aliens landing on Nazca is still portrayed as the most likely possibility. That is no longer the case.
Right. And I actually love your potential explanation of it from its human perspective, far better, resonates with me far more. It certainly makes me feel better than the concept of it being, you know, an alien landing strip. I do want to acknowledge the work of Eric Von Däniken, because I think it was, you know, it really, Eric Von Däniken made the whole world think. He made the whole world think and the whole world talk. And that, I think, is a magnificent achievement. I mean, if I had that on my gravestone when I died, you know, this is a person who made the whole world think and talk, I would feel like a pretty accomplished person. person. So, I mean, I think that is extraordinary in terms of what Eric Von Däniken has been able to achieve. And I grew up with the Chariots of the Gods was on our coffee table when I was growing up. My parents read it. My grandparents read it. I would flip through that book when I was a kid. And so I definitely know that even as a child, I was fascinated by this, you know, and what's interesting about all this is it really appeals to everybody. My father, who's in his late 70s, couldn't wait for this show to come on. He's so excited about it. He's really, you know, he's glued to every second of it. And he loves this stuff. And he's been a Von Däniken fan forever. You know, he has a pretty open mind, and he's finding it all extremely interesting. Okay, so let me ask you this. When I get in spirited discussions with my friends who are very pro UFO, very pro alien intelligence. And you and I both have a lot of them. I have a lot of friends on Facebook who are really committed to this kind of stuff. And they're all really smart, really cool people. And I love talking to them because they make me think, you know, and I will never say I know something isn't true, because I don't. There's a whole lot in this universe that I do not know. So what my perspective is always, I want to learn as much as I can learn. I will tell you this is how it makes me feel. I will tell you this is what I believe. But unless it is something that I can factually prove, I'm not ever going to say it isn't true. So I'm not going to stand here and say aliens didn't do this. I'm going to say it doesn't work for me for these reasons. But sure, tell me more. So my question is this. When I had these discussions with my really intelligent, spirited friends who believe strongly in alien intelligences, they always come back to me and say, if man did this, then why can't we do it now? Why don't we remember how to do this? Why did we lose the ability to use our brains in the way that we did in ancient times if we did this without help? And so my question is, how do you respond to that?
Well, I'm going to reply twice to that. The first thing is, and it's actually from the project management perspective, the Great Pyramid is the greatest building project of the ancient world. It took 4,000 years, pretty much, until somebody built something taller, and that was the Eiffel Tower. The Great Pyramid used thousands and thousands of people who were working together day in, day out. Now, even the Eiffel Tower didn't need those thousands and thousands of people. Do you know that a project like the Great Pyramid, gathering all of these thousands and thousands of people on one site, hasn't been accomplished until a few years ago, and it was twice in Dubai, and one of them was building for the extension for the airport. Dubai is the only place on Earth where there is sufficient knowledge in project management to do these kind of things. So when, until, let's say, 10 years ago, people say, well, you know, we've never built anything like that, have we? And the answer is no, because first of all, you approach it from a slave labor force, unmotivated work people. We all know about the health and safety risks, don't we, which specifically in the Western world make everything 50 times more expensive and 3 times as long. And this is kind of like what makes it unbelievable that our ancestors would be able to pull that off. However, the pyramids were built day in, day out. There was a dedicated workforce who moved from one pyramid to the other. And when you see where we start with a very interesting and a very beautiful pyramid in Zoser, in Saqqara, and you see how they continue onwards, you see that actually from the pyramid just before the Great Pyramid, which is the Red Pyramid in the Shur, to the Great Pyramid, there's really not that much more work to be done. And this is always my thing, which I push back to people who say, well, you know, the Great Pyramid was built by aliens. And I kind of like go, it's like the classic Homer Simpson when he's asked to do the mountain climbing. And he kind of like, you know, he says like, that little hill there? And they should say, no, the bigger one next to it. And he says, that one? No, the big one next to it. And then it's his traditional dough. And it's that kind of thing. You know, people who say the Great Pyramid is made by aliens, well, in that case, you need to tell me and you need to prove to me, or you need to at least accept, if that's what you believe, that the second pyramid right next to it has been built by aliens as well, and that the Red Pyramid of the Shur was built by aliens as well, because from a technical complexity point of view, they are just as complex. Now, the second level to this is that I think alien intelligence and extraterrestrials are like two things which I definitely want to to separate. You know, to some extent, we are aliens to this planet as well, in the sense that we are so different from anything else which is walking around on Earth. We are far more intelligent. We do so many things to this planet, which a bird or an ape or a dinosaur a few million years ago is and was simply unable to do. So we kind of like have this identity crisis that we think we are unique, and that therefore kind of like, you know, we somehow feel that we really have no comparison level. But people who have literally gone out of their mind, specifically the late Terence McKenna and Jeremy Narby, who is an anthropologist, I think has done tremendous work of research into asking this question and differentiating between an extraterrestrial being who comes here and dictates or tells us information, or an alien intelligence. And the UFO phenomenon is a very interesting subject. It's diverse. I love reading some of the material on it, and it inspired the likes of Carl Gustav Jung. And Jung studied the UFO phenomenon for a very long period of time, and his conclusion was basically very similar to Terence McKenna. And both of them were saying that the phenomenon was real. Obviously, there are unexplained flying objects. If you don't know what they are, they're unidentified. But they went beyond that. They said, yes, there is clearly an intelligent control behind this, but there is so much more between heaven and earth that to jump into onto the conclusion that this is ET who's just flying around and seems to be lost completely all the time is simply ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And they were feeling that this was an otherworldly intelligence, an intelligence, you know, whether you want to call it Gaia or, you know, collective unconscious or whatever you want to call it. Let's just agree that whether it's Terence McKenna or Jung, they were describing a non-physical intelligence, a non-physical component. And McKenna pointed out that kind of when he and Shaman went into this out-of-body experiences, then they came back with this information,
right.
A bit like people who have visions about the past and are able to access those bits of information. But before going into that area, there is one final thing which I just want to touch upon, and that is the work of Jeremy Narby. And Jeremy Narby is a very interesting story. He was a relatively successful tennis player up until around the years of 20, and he was also studying to become an anthropologist. And he had to give up tennis because his back basically could not cope with the physical strain of playing tennis at international level. So he had to abandon that career. And by the time he arrived in the Amazon to begin to study the tribes which he was needing to study for his anthropology degree, his back was giving him so much trouble, and nothing in Western medication was able to relieve his pain. So he began to speak to the locals, who said, yes, we can help you. And they came up with a potion, and after a little while, his back was completely healed. Since the age of 20, his back problems have not come back. This is just one story of several of people who've gone to the Amazon and have been confronted with this kind of intellectual medical knowledge. And what Jeremy did was, I think about 5 years ago, he actually took two people from a big Swiss pharmaceutical company into the Amazon because he wanted to make a confrontation between Western-based, very technological, intellectual approach to medicine and medicine development and the native Amazonian herbal tradition of developing all of these things. And after, I think, about 5 days, the people went back to Switzerland and they just said, wow, we have learned so much. We have found new approaches. We have found new information, new way of doing things. This has been such a revelation. So he then asks, Jeremy Narby asks the local shaman, how did you do this? How are you able to do something which is really intellectually superior to anything a machine is able to produce in the Western world and works better as well?
Right.
And they say, and they don't say, oh, well, you know, E.T. came down and told us this, or E.T. lives around the corner and last night we had a drink with him. They point out that they go into a trance, and when they're in a trance, all this information is accessible to the human mind. And so the only thing they do, or only between parentheses, is they bring that down and they apply it. And it is, you know, it's what the ancient Egyptians would have called magic. It's this magical science whereby you go outside of the boundaries of the physical and you add that other dimension to it. And you know, to some extent, there is this alien component to this because there is this other intelligence there. And, you know, I think we are way too undeveloped as a civilization, as a species, to really hammer down what that specifically is. But we have believed in it. You know, religions and spirituality are based upon that existence. We feel it when we open ourselves up to it. And I think to some extent that is probably the basic problem which you are identifying, and I think which I'm identifying as well with the ancient alien thing. There are bits about our history which are completely unknown. And it feels, you know, and in some cases it is proper to ask the questions, did an alien being come here and leave a trace of its presence behind? But rushing into answering the question always of ET, I think is once again for people who are too intellectual and do not encompass and use all of the human senses and all the human faculties.
How do you feel then about when we start talking about things like Atlantis? Where does that come into this? I mean, I know that's a whole nother, you know, sort of can of worms, but where does that tie into not just your point of view, which I certainly want to hear, but the perspectives as you have encountered them of people who are, you know, really advocates and proponents of this alien intelligence? Do they also tend to feel that there were ancient civilizations like Atlantis and Lemuria and some of these other civilizations that are, you know, that have vanished, that brought this kind of intelligence to us as well? Or is it all part and parcel the same thing? Are the aliens and the Atlanteans, Lemurians, from their point of view, all from the same place?
Obviously, you will find so many theories out there that it's a bit of everything. But I think reducing it to, like, the leading lights, I think there is a distinction. But once again, I think, let's go back to the original question which Eric asked, which is, ET was here or an ancient civilization was here, and the ancient civilization was highly developed. Again, there is this detached point of view that we seem to know everything about ancient Egypt, and oh, look, poor Egyptians were so stupid, they couldn't possibly have done this. So this intelligence must have been before, and Atlantis must have built the Great Pyramid. Again, this is wrong from the simple point of view that the ancient Egyptians weren't stupid. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean they built the Great Pyramid, but the basic premise is wrong. So the entire framework in which this thinking operates is wrong. And to some extent, it's also, once again, this disempowerment of, like, whether it is ET giving us this or Atlantis giving us this, we once again are supposed to have this inferiority complex that somehow we are inferior to these lost civilizations. Now, definitely Graham Hancock is part of the ancient aliens discussion. And it was actually interesting to see that he appeared in this one, because he is one of those people who has never gone on the record as saying that he believes in ET. Robert Bovall is identical. But both of them are very much proponents of the fact that there was a lost civilization of Atlantis, which, you know, they dispute as to where precisely it is. Definitely Hancock believes it's in Antarctica. Bovall hasn't been that specific. Again, where it is doesn't really matter that much. But it sometimes gets tied in and it's sometimes set apart. And to some extent, it's part and parcel of the same question, because definitely Eric von Däniken posed those two questions side by side. But, you know, they get filled in slightly different. There's definitely historical evidence for the fact that there is Atlantis. Plato wrote about it. There is information that people after Plato went to the temple of, I think it's Isis in or Nephthys in Sais, and saw the inscription on the column. There is nothing to doubt the fact that, you know, we know from historical records that before 800 BC, roughly, when Greece was born, there was another Greek civilization who lived on the Greek island, which is, things like the Minoan civilization and other civilizations on the Greek mainland. So we now know that this is a fact, that what Plato heard these ancient Egyptians say about, hey, you're not the first in your country, there was this civilization before, that this is a fact. Do we therefore need to push it all the way back to 10,000? Or you know, is it indeed true that Plato was confronted with lunar years rather than solar years, and that hence what seems to be 10,000 years should actually be only about 1,500 years? Again, I think that's something where we need to have far more research done into. And personally, and I have shown you some of it, but it's really such an unfortunate thing that the entire research needs to be redone. There is a very interesting hypothesis from a Belgian historian called Marcel Mesnak, whose archive I went through almost 20 years ago now. And his archives contained extremely detailed information, and he found a civilization in Western Europe, the Megalithic civilization, which did tremendous building works on the surface of France, which can still be seen to a large extent. And when he had done all of this measuring, he found out that the dimensions of these dikes and of these megalithic constructions were identical to the dimensions given by Plato in the Timaeus, and that those dimensions were Atlantis. And of course we know that megalithic civilization was a lost civilization, because pretty much everything roughly disappeared about 1200 BC into nothingness, roughly the same period when the Greek mainland was wiped clean for a few hundred years of a real civilization, and then the Greek civilization came about. So there's lots of things to kind of like go there and explore further. So do I think that Atlantis might have existed? Yes. Do I think that it is precisely what everybody thinks it is, which is this bespoke little island in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean which disappeared? I think that's possible, but I think we are so far away from proving that I actually think it's one of those questions which we shouldn't be trying to ask right now in the Atlantis debate. I think there are other questions on the Atlantis debate which we need to ask previously, or as first questions, before really going all the way out on the Atlantis question.
Excellent answer. Okay, so from there, I want to segue into something that's a little bit delicate, I think, because this is where I bristle. Okay, as open-minded as I like to think that I am, when I watch shows like this, and again, I love this show, and it's so much fun, and I can't wait for the next episode, and I think everyone should watch it because it's so much fun to talk about. I am, as anyone who knows me or has read my books or who listens to me on a regular basis knows, I am a woman of faith. I am a believer in a higher power. I believe in God. I believe in our connection to our divine creator. I have very powerful commitment to my faith. I get really nervous when I see this pendulum swing so far in that direction of alien intelligence science that it essentially replaces any concept of divinity. What I hear with some of these people on this show who are talking is I hear them entirely replacing God with alien intelligence. I hear them basically saying all of these things, whether it's in the biblical accounts, places where we have said, you know, God sustained the Israelites. This is where we're going, right? We're going to talk about this thing where they talk about the manna machine. They talk about what happens when the Israelites are in the desert. And this concept of replacing the idea of the Israelites being sustained through human means and divine means and some kind of beautiful communion between those two things, they have taken it and created something called a manna machine. This idea that alien intelligence actually gave them the ability to survive in the desert by creating some kind of device. All right. I am not a fan of this theory for a lot of reasons. I think it's offensive, actually, to Jewish people. And I would be interested to hear from them to see if anyone who watched this was offended by it, because I kind of was. Again, I'm trying to be open-minded here, but for me, this idea of completely replacing God and our ability to connect with God and become, you know, step into our divinity as God's creations is completely diminished, if not disintegrated by this idea that all of that goes out the window and is replaced by alien intelligence giving us everything that we needed instead of God.
Yes, I mean, there are two things. One of them, which they show, one of them is the mana machine, and the other one is Ezekiel's wheel. And in 1970s, actually Joseph Blumreich sounds to me like a Jewish name, and he's actually the author of the mana machine. So they began reading everything they could read about these two things, and like engineers and architects, came up with extremely detailed drawings and then kind of try to make it in a machine, and hence the mana machine. It's very similar along the lines of like the Joseph Dunn work on saying the Great Pyramid is some kind of hydrogen machine. This is intellectualism, people who do not believe, trying to explain the Bible, and they're trying to explain it away. The people who are factual about the Bible, so to some extent they're fundamentalists, but they're fundamentalists in a very bizarre way. They're fundamentalists in the Bible is true, but it's not about God. and I think that's kind of like, you know, missing the point a bit of the Bible. Now, I think, you know, on a basic level, and this is an intellectual approach, can it be suggested that the mana-machine is an alien device? Yes. Is it likely? No. But the jump which they then make, and this is, I think, the crux of your problem and definitely my problem, the jump which they then make is, oh, well, God therefore equals E.T. And as soon as E.T. has given the Israelites the mana machine, there you go. God no longer exists. Several problems on an intellectual level with that kind of reasoning. And I, you know, again, it's this mindset. We are so intrigued by gadgets, and I think the power of the mana machine and Ezekiel's wheel is very much that. It's people who've been able to come up with an interpretation which makes something look very gadgety, very simple, whereas the mana machine and so many things in the Bible and so many objects, you know, one of the things which isn't actually from the Bible, but it's the light bulbs from a temple in ancient Egypt. People go into this very small chamber and they are confronted with what appears to be light bulbs. And so it has to be a light bulb, right? Well, and we'll again publish it on the website, I did an article about a year ago which clearly shows that, first of all, they're not light bulbs, but that actually the Egyptian creation mythology provides a very concise and very interesting framework for what is being depicted there. And then we are actually in your territory, which is the entire spiritual disciplines of like Heros Gamos and all of these extremely complex and also, well, alien to our Western spirituality disciplines, which, you know, I think is the fact that that these subjects, which you write so beautifully about and so prominently about, the fact that they are not so well known within Western mindset or even within, you know, a Jewish Western mindset, is why we have these weird conclusions as to somehow that the mana machine might be the likeliest explanation as to what is going on there.
Well, I would just like to throw out there again that it doesn't have to be one or the other. I don't think that we have to either say there are alien intelligences or there's God. I mean, even the Vatican has accepted the fact that it's okay to talk about alien intelligences. I mean, I thought that was quite amazing last year when the Vatican made that announcement that it did not go against Catholic tradition or teachings to believe in alien life forms, which I thought was a phenomenal thing for them to say. Of course, it's against. I also thought it was amazing that it's incomprehensible that Jesus was married, but it's okay to believe in aliens.
Well, and I also think to some extent it's one of these things whereby they can now hold intellectual debates, which they're doing, whether these extraterrestrial beings, if they exist, are somehow suffering from original sin, and whether or not Jesus' sacrifice has, you know, like, done away with their original sin. So I think it's like this self-serving kind of like, you know, oh, let's talk a bit more about theoretical things so we do not have to look at the practical problems which the church is being confronted with. So I'm a bit, unfortunately, not all that pleased with the Vatican's stance on it. And like all of these other things, this press announcement, they keep digging up. They've been saying this almost on a twice, every 2 years, the same person of the Vatican Observatory says this, almost like making it pretend that, you know, like the Vatican is really scientific. And kind of like, you know, well, if they were scientific, as you were just pointing out, they would accept certain bits of evidence about the Bible a bit more readily than what you're doing right now.
That's absolutely true. So where does this leave us, Philip? Where does this leave us in the world of ancient aliens and ancient brilliant man and 21st century man? And where are we going?
Well, I think we need to say, you know, like Eric von Däniken was a true spirit revolutionary. He asked a question and he got hammered for it. But when we look 3 decades on, four decades on, he was right to challenge science, and science reacted. So being extremely outspoken and speaking your mind works. And as, again, we need to say that von Däniken put more than 360 questions in roughly a 300-page book. So that means that there's at least one question on every book, on every page, rather. And so that is one thing. I think that's a really good thing. I think we also need to say kudos for this documentary because it actually is trying to push the boundaries and make people think. Unfortunately, I think the ambitions of the program are fail where the entire documentary world, if you want, fails as a whole, where television fails as a whole, which is there is no spirituality on television. There is no place for spirituality on television, it seems, at this moment in time. And I think that's probably the next layer of the ancient aliens debate and also television as a whole, that we need to begin to free ourselves a bit more open and to begin to speak about other intelligences, whether it's Gaia, whether it is an alien intelligence, whether it's God, whether it's cosmic unconsciousness, whatever you want to call it. And I think that is probably the next frontier. And to some extent, that is always kind of what I'm trying to push. I'm always trying to, again, be in the middle and specifically trying to bring various disciplines together. You know, just like anthropology should be married to archaeology, should be married to history. All of these traditions, you know, the Mayans aren't dead. They're our descendants. All of these things, they cannot be seen in isolation. When we take them out in isolation, they make for interesting television. They will be interesting, but there should be more. So I think the ancient alien debate, where I would really like to see it going, and it's a suggestion which I've been pushing within that circle of people who are interested in ancient aliens themselves, is that I feel that they should try to move away from trying to make everything into, oh, could aliens have built this, into actually coming up with 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 examples from across the world, which in their opinion is the best evidence for an alien intervention or presence in a civilization, or, you know, just or an alien artifact, if you want. And that we should focus on those 5 and try to answer the question as such, rather than continue to ask really extreme questions time and time again, because that is beginning to get, on some occasions, repetitive. And it's definitely not going to advance it. You know, like, the initial push which von Däniken gave by asking these questions has paid off. Now just keep parroting it might not necessarily work. So there has to be something more to it than that. But I think it's good that these kind of questions are actually given airtime prominently on television without ridicule, because there has been so much ridicule and ad hominem attacks and personal attacks on the likes of von Däniken and Hancock and to some extent Bovaal over the last decade, specifically roughly the period 1995-1997, but even like the likes of Henry Lincoln, who tackles the subject slightly different, like René Chateau, just they all got attacked. So the fact that they are given a point and a stool and a position to prominently proclaim the question once again, I think is good. But it shouldn't stop there. It should develop, and I think rather than, again, to repeat, rather than just keep asking the question, I think there should be a concentration on 2, 3, or 4 or 5 items and try to move that forward.
So rather than saying everything we can't explain was the result of alien intelligence, let's talk about those issues that we have some really, really fantastic, interesting, you know, evidence and perspectives on, and let's focus on those rather than just trying to blanket everything with this sort of alien idea.
Absolutely.
You know, now you know I'm going to say this because you know me very well, and a lot of my listeners know I'm going to say this, but here's my other issue with this. There are no women being interviewed in this field. Now, I think there was one woman on the first episode. Now, I know there are a lot of women who care about these subjects and who are interested in these subjects and who are writing about these subjects, but I want to continue to throw this out there to the History Channel. I am going to be a bug in their ear for for eternity about this. I want to see more women on the History Channel. I want to see more female perspectives on the History Channel. Why don't more women have something to say about this particular circumstance? And if, you know, why aren't they being interviewed? Why aren't we talking to women? Why aren't there women at these conferences? You know, it's really, really time to bring some female perspective into all this. And, you know, maybe there's a little bit of balance to be had if that happens. I mean, maybe that is part of the problem. This current concept of looking at alien intelligence is very cerebral, and it's very masculine overall. I'm not seeing a lot of spirit. I'm not seeing anything. And I think that's the problem for me. And maybe I'm not their target audience. I mean, we already know the demographic of the History Channel and the Discovery Channel is male. I've been told, as you know, we have discussed before, by a number of producers that I am way too female for either of those two channels, that I am not their demographic. They don't want me on there, and they don't care if I watch. But, you know, let's face it, 53% of the world is female, by last count, the last one that I read anyway. So, you know, half of us are not being represented here. And is it so crazy to think that we could create programming and create conferences and, you know, create projects where the female perspective is involved and there is some balance here? And we are able to say, look, this incredibly cerebral male-dominated field is really cool and really interesting, but what happens if we bring a little bit of female spirit in here and start looking at it from a wider, broader, and more balanced point of view?
I think, I mean, first of all, it's the yes is the short answer, but it needs to have a bit more depth to it, I think, because there is, as I said, it's a very intellectual kind of like questioning. And as a result, almost everybody in this field is male. While you were asking the question, I was scanning my brain to come up with women in there, and I can come up with one, Antoine Gigal. And I think the reason why there are no women, I mean, okay, Linda Shaley has unfortunately been dead for a number of years, but she would normally be sitting in this kind of documentary. The woman whose name I unfortunately can't remember, Ruth something, who did research on Corral in Peru, is a woman. They would shift the question away from specifically the intellectual ancient alien thing and would move it more towards the middle ground of, you know, we have been intelligent in the past. So I think you've nailed the problem on the head. It's a problem, but if you want to make only the ancient alien thing, by default you will come up with just men, because it is a very intellectual area where I think quite a lot of women are not interested, because it is so intellectual and it's not really where it should be.
Well, and I just want to say, when you say that women are not interested because it's so intellectual, I know that you are not saying it's because women are not intelligent enough. What I think you're saying is because it's not complete enough.
Cerebral is probably a better
word. we're certainly intelligent enough to understand it, but I think that we want more than that. You know, I love the reconstructions of the machines and everything else as much as everybody else, but I want to know where that takes us next. You know, I want to take it to the next level. I want to feel something when I watch these shows, as well as learn something and see something. You know, and I know that there's a lot of guys out there listening right now who are going to say, Kathleen, shut up and go watch
watch Lifetime. What I want to do is I want to create a spirit network where we can actually create this kind of programming, the kind of programming that you're talking about, where it is balanced and where we're looking at these issues from a broader and more balanced perspective. So if there's any billionaires out there who want to finance a new network, we're more than happy to create the programming for you.
And this show, which unfortunately is coming to an end, would then be on the Spirit Revolution, would be probably a TV show. With that, until next week.
I'm Kathleen McGowan.
I'm Philip Coppens.
The Truth Against the World.